This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. It's the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. We're taking the holiday to check out the fireworks and celebrate America. So today we're going to hear an encore presentation about the American dream. Or maybe some might call it an American fantasy.
Money!
Over the past year, KCRW has followed the work of a few local developers who build modern-day palaces, enormous mansions with amenities such as bowling alleys and hair salons, even nightclubs. And they cater to the upper part of the 1%, the billionaires who want show places. Think of the Aaron Spelling Mansion in Holmby Hills, which just sold for the jaw-dropping price of $120 million. That one took a long time to sell. And other so-called giga mansions have been on the market for a long, long time. Does that mean real estate developers might have overestimated the demand? KCRW reporter Anna Scott has been checking in on the business of so-called giga mansions. She's here with me right now. Hi, Anna.
Hi.
How many of these so-called giga mansions are there?
Well, I should first say that there is no strict definition of giga mansion, but I've been looking at properties that cost $30 million or more, just as a loose guideline. So I checked with the real estate firm Coldwell Banker in Beverly Hills, and they told me they have roughly 45 listings in this bracket. The other thing that's important to mention is that some of these are older properties. Like the original Giga Mansion was probably the Spelling Manor, which the TV producer Aaron Spelling had built in the 1980s.
Father of Tori, yeah,
exactly. Took the words right out of my mouth. But some of these are new, and that's where KCRW has been following this. There are a few developers who are really taking a gamble on this piece of the market, and they're building these enormous properties from the ground up with some success, but it looks like now things might be slowing down.
All right, so who are these developers doing this?
Well, one of them is named Niall Niami, and I went to one of his houses recently. It's in the hills of Beverly Hills on a cul-de-sac street, and I got a tour from a real estate agent named Rainey Williams.
When you walk in, so you have that beautiful foyer that flows into the living room, a fireplace separating the living room to the dining room. You have the hot tub built into the pool, and then you also have a tub. So if you continue on to the kitchen here, you're going to pass a powder room to the right, and then the kitchen.
So I want to just set the scene for you here. So this house is about 20,000 square feet. Very large. The developer calls it Opus. A lot of these properties have names. That's one of the hallmarks of giga mansions. You walk in, and you have your living room, your sitting area, your kitchen, and a lot of it is surrounded by these retractable glass walls that, with the press of a button, recede into these marble sections of wall. So you have this entirely open area that opens onto a patio with a long, skinny, infinity-edge pool and a view of the whole city. Okay, you know, these are typical things that you would expect to find in an incredibly expensive house. But giga mansions also tend to have very over-the-top amenities, or the newer ones anyway, stuff that nobody needs. For example, right off the kitchen of this particular house, there's a room that's about the size of a walk-in closet. Mm-hmm. It is a champagne room.
Those are all magnums of Cristal. And then the ceiling height really requires that gold ladder that's in there. You really need that.
Gold ladder.
Yes, there's a gold ladder so you can get to the higher bottles of Cristal in the champagne room. This house actually comes with a lot of alcohol, Steve. It's worth noting. And then the house has the second level doesn't go up, it goes down. So there's a basement level instead of an upstairs. And downstairs, you'll find a second pool, an indoor pool, a wellness center, which includes a gym and a mini hair salon, and also a giant fish tank.
It's a Cristal aquarium.
But no fish, because the developer, Niall Niami, does not like them.
Because he thinks fish smell. I really just don't think he's really one with fish. I think,
but he does like aquariums.
But he loves aquarium. He loves water.
Yeah.
Okay. Now this is your massage room. So very peaceful.
Of course, there's a massage room. Cristal aquariums. These houses aren't selling though. How long has this one been on the market?
Yeah, this one's been on the market for more than 2 years. And when it originally hit the market, it was priced at $100 million. Now it's just under $60 million. So I asked the developer, Niall Naomi, about this.
When this house was first finished, you know, it was a different world in the marketplace. We had that house next door. It sold for $70 million. And at the time, you know, we had offers for more than we're asking now. But that's the only reason we have this house now. Is because I priced it too high. So it is what it is.
So what he was talking about there was a few years ago, the house right next door sold for $70 million to the creator of the video game Minecraft.
Oh, okay.
He's a billionaire.
Yeah.
There were some other big sales, and it kind of created this frenzy around these ultra-luxury properties. But Niall Naomi is not the only guy building these who might have overestimated the demand. There's a few of these developers, and about a year ago, they all got a lot of attention for having projects on the market at the same time, but they're all still on the market, and they've seen big price reductions. The guy who built the $70 million mansion next door, he has another project that was originally priced at $250 million.
Wow.
It's still for sale, but it's been marked down to just a mere $150 million.
So do these developers, Anna, do they like throw a dart at the wall and they're like, hey, I'll sell this for $100 million? I mean, it seems like it's really arbitrary. Do they think that they're really going to get that much money for these places?
Yeah. Well, sometimes these giant price tags are definitely part of their marketing strategy. If they come out and say, hey, I've got a $100 million house, I've got a $250 million house, they know they're going to get attention and it may or may not sell for that much. And I actually talked about this very phenomenon with a man named David Kramer. He's an executive vice president at Hilton and Highland in Beverly Hills, a brokerage that handles a lot of these ultra luxury properties. And he says, you never know what you're going to get with one of these, but sometimes
you'll come out with a price that'll make a splash and it gets attention worldwide. And quite frankly, it benefits the news organizations who get to say a billion or half a billion dollar home as much as it does a developer. And I don't know that there is a real expectation that it's going to sell for that price. And you do see reductions after a while.
And you look at the real estate market in Los Angeles and all these places are, you know, I mean, obviously moderately priced homes are going for over asking price. That's what you hear about.
Yeah, it's almost kind of like the opposite of what we think of as the normal housing market in a way. In the normal housing market, sometimes things are underpriced on purpose because it'll start a bidding war. And with this stuff, they put a huge price tag on it and most of the time they're not getting that much. But they are still getting a lot of money in a lot of cases. So we should make that clear. I mean, just last week, a brand new mansion in Bel Air sold for $45 million. So I don't mean to paint a picture that there's not just an unbelievable amount of money changing hands with certain properties in Los Angeles.
So who's buying these homes at this level? What kinds of people are buying a $45 million home?
Well, property records are public, so I can tell you exactly who's bought some of these most expensive homes in the past few years. The $45 million one that I just mentioned went to a Saudi buyer. Some other buyers in past few years of these high-priced homes are Jeff Green. He's a billionaire based in Florida who actually made a lot of his money betting against the housing market.
Betting against the housing market.
You know the book, The Big Short, and the
yes.
movie? So he's not one of the guys in the books, but he's like one of those guys that bet against the housing market before the crash and made a lot of money. You've got Bruce Karsh. He's a billionaire investor. He's the co-founder of Oaktree Capital Management, which is based here in LA. He bought one of these properties. Jaime Hilinski, he's a Colombian banker and real estate developer who's mostly based in London. In short, these are people of enormous wealth with multiple properties around the country, even around the world. So they're not necessarily looking for a primary residence.
Or like a domicile, right? Like someplace that they're going to plant themselves for years.
Not necessarily. I mean, I don't know for sure, of course, yeah. But they have more than one property.
When you look at these homes and how much they're selling for, and I can't help, because we're having this discussion about these giga mansions, think of the inequality here. Like how ridiculous this sounds, especially in a place that has such a problem with homelessness, such a housing, well, so many politicians saying there's a housing shortage. It is really hard to hear about this incredible wealth and not think about all of the people sleeping on the streets.
Yeah. As you said at the very beginning, Los Angeles is definitely a place of extremes when it comes to income, for sure. And you're right. It's hard to step into this world and not think about the other end of the spectrum. And it's also true that that the very rich are building these bigger and bigger houses because they have more money than ever before, because we do have this widening inequality. But it isn't just billionaires who are getting bigger and bigger houses. I spoke to a man named Robert Frank, who's an economics professor at Cornell University. He's written many books. And his next book actually has a section on these giga mansions of Los Angeles. And he says that they can set off something that he calls a spending cascade. So it begins with these people at the very tippy top. They get these giga mansions, but then the people who socialize with them see that and feel pressure to upgrade themselves.
So people gather and they see that their peers have a house with a ballroom that can accommodate a large orchestra and hundreds of guests. Now we need a house like that. So they build bigger. And one step at a time, it cascades all the way down the earnings ladder.
So this is like Keeping Up with the Joneses, right?
Pretty much, yeah. And Robert Frank says that the median house size in this country today is 50% bigger than it was in the 1980s.
50%,
and he blames it on this phenomenon.
So where does this end, Anna? I mean, have we finally reached this uppermost limit of how, I don't know, how big and extravagant and opulent these houses can get, at least here in L.A.? I mean, given that a lot of these homes are not selling. I mean, they've been on the market and they're not, nobody's gobbling them up.
Yeah, well, if you want to know exactly how big houses can get, the developer we heard from earlier, Niall Niamey, has one that's supposed to be finished this summer in Bel Air that he calls The One. This is kind of the mother of all giga mansions.
Really?
And it hasn't officially hit the market yet because it's not quite finished. But this house is about 100,000 square feet.
Wow.
It has 20 bedrooms, a bowling alley. It comes with art. It has a jellyfish room. This is a room where the ceilings and the walls are made of jellyfish tanks. I mean, no one needs this house. This is ultimate giga mansion. He has said that he is going to price this house at $500 million.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, no house in Los Angeles has ever sold for even close to that. But Niamey argues that he will get top dollar for this one.
The One is a totally different animal. I think it's an easier sell than any house in L.A. because you can never build it again.
So he said you can never build it again because since he started construction on this, the city has actually changed some rules. So it is not possible to build something that huge anymore. So he thinks the uniqueness of it will be a selling point. But when I asked him if this house was still going to be priced at $500 million, listen to what he said.
The number's out there. So, I mean, I don't think we're going to change that. But I think that obviously we'll listen to offers when they come in.
So
the number's out there.
Yeah, backing off that a little bit. Another interesting thing is that he is looking outside of the billionaire buyer pool on this. He said that he's now planning to market this house, the One, to Fortune 500 companies as a possible corporate retreat destination.
Oh, like to send employees.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, for guys like Niamey, they have to think creatively about what they're going to do with these properties, how they're going to market them, because for them, the giga mansion sector is a business, and it's a risky one. Niall Niamey got a ton of attention for this $500 million listing, but it's easy to forget this is an enormous business gamble, and public records show that he bought the land where that property is for $28 million. He's taken out more than $80 million in loans on it, so he's already looking at having to break sales records in terms of price just to break even on this project, and I think he's looking to do more than break even.
KCRW's Anna Scott reporting on the Giga Mansions. Anna, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, coming up, from red ink and real estate to the red planet in the solar system, the humble story of a JPL engineer who went from the potato fields to the mission that digs into Mars. A truly American story. You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Steve Chiotakis back with Greater LA on KCRW on this 4th of July. I hope you're having a good holiday. What's more American than A, space exploration, and B, the child of immigrants seeking a better life? To find the intersection of those two very patriotic things, and today, we go a little farther than Southern California. We're taking you to Mars. Well, as close as you can get to Mars from here on planet Earth. We're at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, and you're listening to the wind on Mars. The engineers say that wind blows 10 to 15 miles per hour from northwest to southeast. And scientists at JPL recorded that wind. They're the ones leading Mars missions, like the ones with the Spirit and Opportunity rovers that, you know, roved across the red planet. The newest Mars spacecraft is the InSight lander, which touched down on November 26th. NASA sent InSight to drill into the planet and study what's going on inside, to record the temperature, for example, and the pressure and vibrations. Every move InSight makes on Mars is first tested at JPL. In a building that from the outside just looks like an ordinary warehouse.
Okay, I'll go through some of the rules as soon as I got everybody in here.
Hi, come on in.
The engineer who leads those tests is Marlene Martinez Sundgaard. Now, Marlene is not what you might think of as a typical NASA engineer.
I remember my first field was beans, and then I worked in sugar beets, and then we did potatoes.
She's the daughter of migrant workers from Mexico.
Starting at the age of 13, for the next 3 summers, I would get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. We had to be in the field by 5 o'clock, and we would just start working, and we'd be working for the next, 9 or 10 hours.
From the potato fields to JPL, Kirsten Zilm has Marlene's story.
Now you're going to see where all the really good toys are.
The real InSight lander is a robot up on Mars. Down here, Marlene works with an exact replica. It's about 5 feet tall, the same size as she is. The lander stands on 3 stilts. Its big dome is covered in gold foil. It has solar panels and a long arm with a claw on the end. Nearby are a seismometer and the so-called mole, built to hammer deep into the Martian surface.
This is where all the good stuff happens, and we actually get to use our hands and do things that we're going to do on Mars and actually see how they're going to come out as close as we can replicate the systems.
Marlene is a 35-year-old engineer. Her dark hair falls over the white lab coat, which almost reaches her ankles. She's wearing jeans and white sneakers underneath. To simulate the red Mars surface, Marlene moves gray gravel in the sandbox. She is not surrounded by the vastness of space, but by measuring instruments, caution tape, cameras, and lights.
I would love to go to Mars. I know it sounds crazy, but ever since I was a kid, I've just always wanted to go to space. I've always wanted to look back onto the Earth. I've wanted to just go and explore.
Marlene's dream of space exploration started when her father showed her and her 4 siblings the stars from their backyard. Then, at 5 years old, she learned a song about space in kindergarten.
I sang a song on Mother's Day, and it was a song called Mission Control. And I remember I had this like little solo part, and the words were, "I may be small, but I'm growing. Watch one day, and you'll see space is wide open and waiting for me.
Maybe I'm small, but I'm growing. Watching one day, you will see. Space is wide open and waiting for me."
Marlene did not have any role models. Her parents and grandparents were migrant workers from Mexico. Each year, they came to Washington State to work in the fields for 9 months. Then, in the winter months, the family moved back to Mexico. The kids left the American school system and went to school in Mexico for those few months each year. Marlene spoke enough Spanish to talk with her grandparents, friends, and neighbors. She did not know enough words to understand cell division, gravity, and other high school subjects.
I would just really quickly write down as fast as I could what the teacher was saying, and then I would get home and I would have my mom or dad translate it for me and tell me what was the teacher writing on the board. I have no idea what this all means. It was a little bit confusing, and it was really difficult.
Another thing made school difficult. Marlene's mouth twitched. Her eyes winked. She repeated whole sentences. It took her years to understand that her tics are part of a neurological disorder she has, Tourette syndrome. Today, Martina Sundgaard is a member of the board of directors for a Tourette syndrome camping organization. Every summer, she shares her story with kids who come to camp.
I try to inspire them to, you know, follow their dreams. Just because you have Tourette syndrome, you might have a few more obstacles to overcome, but it doesn't mean you can't do it. You can still reach for your dreams and try to achieve everything that you think is possible.
Marlene took her first step toward achieving her dream of becoming an astronaut at age 13, when she won a space essay contest. The prize? 1 week of space camp in Alabama.
They put us in like a gravity simulator that some of the astronauts trained in. And then I sat in what they called the 6DF chair, 6 degrees of freedom chair, and it would hover off the floor just a little bit. So I was floating. And so that was just so much fun.
From hovering in an astronaut suit in space camp, Marlene went straight back to picking beans.
That was also the beginning of just me saying, okay, I'm definitely not going to be staying in the field. I'm definitely going to space. What do I need to do to get there?
She knew that first of all she needed good grades in school, and got those. Then she got internships in space research. Then a full scholarship to study aerospace engineering at the University of Washington. Marlene Martinez Sundgaard understands that she now is a role model for girls and young women. It motivates her to inspire them, especially daughters of immigrants.
When I started college, I was behind everybody else. So I had to play catch up just to get the grades I needed to land a really good job and get really good internships and stuff like that. So that's pretty much, I think, the battle that a lot of students from Hispanic communities are trying to fight right now, is just have people in their lives convince them that they can get a degree in engineering and a degree in medical science or a degree in physics, just to give them the confidence to say, hey, go for it. You can do it. You just need to apply yourself and study hard, and you can be anything you want. And I think that's what a lot of people are missing.
Marlene has not given up her dream of going to Mars. 3 times she applied for the NASA astronaut program. The rejection letters are framed in her house. They are reminders of where she still wants to go. Meanwhile, in Pasadena's Jet Propulsion Laboratory Mars testbed, she came very close to feeling as if she really was on the red planet. It happened when she and her team adjusted gravel in the sandbox after InSight sent pictures of the landing site down to Earth.
It was the first time that I put on the HoloLens, and instead of seeing test bed in front of me like I was used to, I saw red Mars in front of me. And I just thought, oh my God, this is Mars. And you could feel like you're walking on it. Your mind just starts to play tricks on you.
Marlene stayed focused on the task ahead, which was to simulate the Mars surface as carefully and as precisely as she could. Only on the way home, she let her feelings go.
In my car, I just started sobbing because I just couldn't believe what I had done that day. But it was just, it was amazing. I mean, that was as close as I've been to walking on Mars, and it was pretty cool.
Marlene Martinez Sundgaard has a 2-year-old son. Her husband also is a NASA engineer, but one with no dream to go to space. Still, she will apply for the astronaut program again next year. And she keeps studying so that when the first manned spacecraft heads to Mars, Marlene will be the best woman for the job in space. For KCRW, I'm Kerstin Sim.
I want to study the planets. I want to study the stars. I want to go up to Venus or Mars.
That's our show for today on this 4th of July. Next week, what some utilities are doing to avoid the devastating and very expensive wildfire catastrophes of the past, and a photo exhibit that chronicles the history of hip-hop. I hope you'll join us next week. Coming up next on KCRW, The Bookworm reads you a story. Stay tuned for Michael Silverblatt immediately following us here. We are grateful for the tiny nation of people who make this show run every day. Our producer is Catherine Barnes. Our editor is Sonia Geis. Phil Richards and Ray Guarna engineer and mix the show. Christian Bordahl runs the operation. I'm Steve Chiatakis. We're at kcrw.com/greaterLA. You can also check out the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for your time and ear today. Happy 4th of July. Let's do it again next week.